Okay, we're live. It's very unceremonious, isn't it? It just kind of happens. There's no like fireworks or nothing That's fancy nice. Happens. All right, Eric. E-R-I-K, yeah? E-R-I-K, yeah.
I think it's spelled with a C, but it is with a K.
I think I did. I actually texted someone telling them that you were coming on. And as I wrote E-R-I-K in my head, I was like, I'm pretty sure I spelled that with a C when I put it on the YouTube. But I never went back and checked. Thanks for coming on, man. I appreciate it. This thanks has been a long, protracted, a drawn out courtship trying to get you to come on. You're a hard man to pin down. Where do you live?
Normally, I live in Copenhagen.
Okay.
In Denmark.
Yeah.
But I've been living in the countryside for the past 6 months.
Right.
My girlfriend and I just had a baby.
Excellent. 7 months ago,
and we wanted to start out in the countryside. So we just rented a nice summer house close to the forest, the sea, few people, many animals.
Whereabouts? So you're still in Denmark, though?
I'm still in Denmark. It's the Danish countryside. It's approximately 40 kilometers north of Copenhagen.
Right.
So it's just simple and nice.
Okay, so you're kind of what's that country beside you there? Sweden? It's like Copenhagen, is it? Is that Sweden?
Well, one of the neighboring countries to Denmark is Sweden. Another one is Germany.
So like you're up here somewhere? Like around there somewhere?
Exactly.
Okay. Each. That's Sweden there, right?
That's right.
Or that's it. Yeah, okay. What's the weather like there now then? Is it still kind of wintry and cold and stuff, or is it getting
it's,
nice?
Similar to Ireland.
Shit then.
It's not
okay.
Too cold, it's just bleak.
A bit dark,
grainy.
Great. My God, I had no idea Copenhagen was over there. I had no idea there was two bits to Denmark.
Three bits.
Is that a separate bit there as well?
Yeah.
Wow. Jeez, I literally thought Denmark was just like that peninsula and that was it. I'm so uneducated. No. Is that that's not Denmark too, is it? Over there?
It is.
What?
It's called Bornholm, the sunny island.
Is that populated? Like, do people live there?
It's populated and a lot of tourists go there in the summer.
Okay.
It's nice.
Cool. It's quite a big distance away. How did they manage to nab that?
I don't know.
God, it's very far away. Yeah, every day is a school day, getting educated. So you live in Denmark, and how's fatherhood? That's your first child, so how's that going?
First child, it's amazing. My girlfriend and I really love it, really enjoy it. It's the first child, but hopefully not the last.
Okay, I follow.
So you told me that you have two children already, with a third one coming in a month.
Yeah.
But with a bit of luck, we're going to surpass you.
Wow, okay.
That's the goal, at least. But one at a time.
Do you have a number in your head? Or are you like, I want five?
No, just one at a time.
Are you an only child, or have you got siblings?
I have two sisters.
Okay. Spur your idea to have more than one child, the fact that you had siblings?
No. No, we just, we didn't plan on my girlfriend being pregnant. It just happened. And then the pregnancy and the birth went really well, really smooth, no complications at all. And the baby is really nice. And I know that it's something that, like, presumably all parents think and say, but it's just a really nice baby, super easy, brings us a lot of joy. The baby is very similar to my girlfriend, which is good.
Okay, yeah.
So because everything has been so smooth and enjoyable, we just want more. We also think that it's good for a child not to be a lonely child. It's probably good to have siblings.
Yeah, I remember when we had our first child, I was kind of like, kind of happy with one. Like, she's great, but it was a big adjustment. And then when my wife made the same point as you of like, but like if we have one child and she's on her own, you know, like at least if she has a sibling. And I was like, right, okay, fine. So we had a second child. And then after we had two, she said, I thought we were done. And she said, oh, maybe we could have a third. And I was like, well, why? Like, they both have each other now. And then she said, yeah, but if one of them goes somewhere, then the other one will be on its own. I was like, but like that could always, you could have 10 kids and one kid could be left on their own. I was like, your logic is starting to fall apart. Like, there's holes in your logic now that it's just like, well, you just keep having kids so nobody's ever alone. But like, yeah, it turns out that if there's a tied vote in the house, I don't carry the swing vote. It's not my, I get vetoed pretty easily, but I don't carry the swing vote.
But as I said, we're not planning anything. We're just living our life and doing nothing to prevent it.
Has it changed like how you approach your work and stuff? Like, is it more, because obviously you travel a lot for seminars and stuff. Like, you were in somewhere in Spain, was it Lanzarote or somewhere like that, for like a couple of weeks? Is that like arduous being away then? Do they come with you, or are you like a guilt-laden coach that's away from home?
I did an elite training camp in Tenerife in January. Tenerife. That's the event that you're referring to. That was 1 week, and I brought my girlfriend and the baby with me, and that worked really well. You know, when I was working, I was working. And when I wasn't working, I think it was fine for the athletes to get a little bit of a break. Yeah. And I could spend time with the family. So I think that worked well. And usually I travel almost every week to do a seminar or some kind of training camp, some kind of event. And, you know, that's fine. It's like, firstly, I have to put food on the table. And I work, so my girlfriend doesn't have to, so she can commit to being a mother, which is what she wants to do. And I also love my work. It's really important for me to be able to focus on my career, to build my business, to develop as a coach. And, you know, when I'm traveling and coaching and working, I miss my family. And when I'm home, I really enjoy my time with them. And I think that's a good thing.
Yeah. Do you find it hard to switch off?
Usually I travel Friday and Monday, and then I work sometimes a bit Friday and all Saturday, all Sunday. And then I'm like completely home Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And of course, some of Monday, some of Friday.
And do you find it hard to switch off from coaching? Like, are you a coach who's constantly accessible from the athletes that you work with and stuff? Or are you like, I will contact you between 9 and 3 or whatever?
No, I'm kind of almost always online.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is it difficult to switch off then and just be like, all right, I'm home, and you know what I mean?
Yeah, I don't think it's a problem. It's just, you know, I don't, you know, when I'm traveling and I'm working hands-on in real life. But in a sense, I'm always working. People can always get in touch with me. That's how I want it, and I enjoy it.
Yeah.
I don't really think of it, you know, like, I love what I do. So to some extent, it's not really work for me. It's just what I like to do.
Yeah, I follow. I'm going to butcher this. Dagmara Kulis? Coolies. I don't know.
Yeah.
Eric is a fantastic coach. We just had him over for a seminar this weekend. And then Roman says, aloha. I remember the smart gentleman from behind the scenes, Sarah, and BKG coach, mustache. we'll get to all that. Is weightlifting always been your speciality? Did you weightlift yourself when you were younger and then transferred into a coach, or did you just develop an interest in it?
Yeah, okay. I'm going to give you the long answer. So I grew up in the Danish countryside, approximately 40 kilometers north of Copenhagen, not far from where we're living right now. And I went to a small local school, which stopped at the 7th grade. And up until that point, I played tennis and I played handball and a little bit of soccer and a bit of swimming, just like a lot of different things. I was active, but I wasn't really hooked, really committed to anything. But then for the eighth grade, all the pupils from the small local school had to go to a much bigger school. And at that bigger school, where we had to go for eighth and ninth grade, there was a gymnasium. And attached to that gymnasium, there was a weightlifting club, like a real Olympic weightlifting club. And every day on my way to school, I would pass by the club, and they had like big windows, and you could see the people training. And to me, at that time, they were fucking jacked. Like, they were huge, and they were lifting massive weights. And I think I just had a healthy instinct. I was like, I think 15 years old, and you know, I wanted to train. I wanted to get like big and strong. And I signed up for some kind of like strength course where you would be able to go to the weightlifting club and just do physical training, not Olympic weightlifting, just like physical training a few times per week. And I was totally hooked. And after 6 months of just doing, you know, normal physical training, you know, bench press, dips, just basic stuff, I was asked by the local weightlifting coach if I wanted to try weightlifting. And I just, I said yes. And just
why did he ask you that? Was he like poaching, or did he see something in you?
I think he saw that I was committed, like that I really wanted it. I was definitely not the most talented, but I was just like really hooked. As I told you, I had dabbled in a lot of different sports, but hadn't really committed to anything. But I was really committed to, let's say, physical training.
Yeah. So I'm just going to stop you.
So yeah, the weightlifting coach got me started with weightlifting, and I became completely obsessed with weightlifting. And, you know, this particular weightlifting club had a really good culture, in the sense that they would frown upon people that were talented but not hardworking, and they would exalt people that worked hard regardless of their innate talent. And I really wasn't that physically talented, but I was really dedicated and I was really willing to work hard. So when I started Olympic weightlifting, I went from nothing but the physical training I had been doing for the past 6 months to training five times a week with the team. Like, never miss a session unless I was sick. So I just became completely obsessed with weightlifting. I totally loved it. But gradually, I began to realize that like my real talent would be for coaching and not for being a weightlifter myself. And when I was 20, I had already moved to Copenhagen and I was training at another weightlifting club. And I got the opportunity to transition into coaching the youth team. And at this point in time, you know, weightlifting was a small niche sport, no opportunity whatsoever for making like a real living. It was just driven by passion. And CrossFit hadn't arrived on the scene yet. So it was just something I did because I loved it, both training weightlifting, training in general, coaching. I was just really passionate about it, but I couldn't expect to make a living from it. So after a couple of years of training the youth team and having really good results with them, but also learning a lot as a coach, I decided to just stop coaching and go into university instead. But then after a few years of that, I decided to quit it. And then I had a period of time where I just didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. But then I was contacted by some people that had been members in the weightlifting club in Copenhagen. And they'd been doing kind of like functional training, like circle training, like proto CrossFit. And they had seen me coach the youth team. And we were on friendly terms. And they just remembered me coaching there. So they opened a CrossFit box as some of the first people opening up a CrossFit box in Copenhagen. And they contacted me and asked me if I wanted to come and coach them and the other coaches in Olympic weightlifting. and I just jumped on the opportunity, and then it just grew from there.
So when you're 20, what made you realize that? Was it your physical limitations made you think that I should focus on coaching, or did you just get more enjoyment out of coaching than you did doing it yourself, if you know what I mean?
Yeah. Okay. So I think I've always been quite objective and rational, and I could see that I had to work really hard to get limited results, and a lot of my teammates would either get much better results with the same work, or they could manage quite good results with a minimum effort. At the same time, they just weren't good coaches. You know, coaching is completely different. So I didn't have that much talent for weightlifting as such, but I think I had a lot of talent for coaching and an interest in coaching, which is, of course, very important. And I was very competitive. Like, I really wanted to compete. And being a weightlifter myself wasn't really a good avenue for me in terms of being successful at competing. But I thought that as a coach, I actually had the opportunity to get really good results.
So do you, like, when you're coaching then, is that, like, are you scratching a competitive itch when you're sending an athlete out, when you're like, oh, I worked with that person, I got them, I helped them get to the level that they're at, ergo, that's success for me?
You know, I'm much older now, and my priorities are different. Back in the day, I was very competitive, which I think is not a bad thing. It just has to be channeled in a productive direction. But yeah, of course, what was so important for me those couple of years where I was training the youth team was that I just started with one person. Like, there was another coach in the weightlifting club, like the head coach, but he had his hands full, and, you know, he appreciated that I really wanted to coach, and he gave me the opportunity to coach one youth lifter. And I took that guy. Well, he was quite young, so he wasn't really a guy. He was more like a boy, but like that teenager. I took him and I transformed him. And I think that's what coaching is essentially about. It's not about conveying knowledge as such. It's about transforming the person that you're working with. So I took my student and I transformed him into something better. And I was lucky because he had two brothers who was also interested in weightlifting. So I started working with the other brother, and I started the transformation of him as well. And then I got the third brother, and I began the transformation of him as well. And then there was a fourth student that I also worked with, who proved to be the best of the four. And like as I said, like the key lesson for me was that I took someone who had a good attitude and certainly also talent for weightlifting, but who was very inexperienced. And then I started learning that person weightlifting. I started the transformation from, you know, any given starting point to being a really technically sound weightlifter.
When you started coaching CrossFit then, and like getting involved with CrossFit, did you have to like park some of that desire for perfection when it comes to weightlifting? Because like, it, I could see how it would be frustrating for someone who's like pure, whose pure focus is technique and like the minutia of completing a lift, and then you go and watch someone do like Grace or Isabel or something, and you're like pulling your hair out being like, no, that's not the way it's supposed to be done. Like, did you have to kind of separate your, like, the weightlifting coach and just accept that it's that that's not what it's about, that it's a, like a broad thing and not as specific?
I think one of my advantages is that I realized quite early that Olympic weightlifting is one sport and CrossFit is another sport, and CrossFitters shouldn't become weightlifters. They should simply improve the barbell game as part of their overall CrossFit game.
Yeah.
So that really wasn't a problem for me. In the beginning, one of my problems was that I was perfectionistic in terms of technique, but also impatient. And developing my patience over time has made me a much better coach.
You and John Singleton go way back, right? You guys like worked together like 10 years ago ish.
Yeah, ish.
Yeah, it was like kind of the, from what I gather, it was kind of, was this sort of like the inception of the program before it became the program? Was like you and him?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you still talk to John?
Sure.
Okay. Just your yeah, maybe wonder if you're still on good terms.
No, we are. He was in Copenhagen a few months back, and we met up for dinner and a good long talk.
That's cool. I kind of find it would be difficult not to like John. Like, he's kind of, I don't really see how someone could be like, no, that guy's an asshole. Like, he just doesn't really have that in him. With him then, how did that happen? Because I guess that's your sort of, for me anyway, on a timeline, maybe you can correct me, but for me on your timeline, that would be your move into elite competitive CrossFit, like when regionals sort of came about and stuff.
Well, it started a little bit before that. So as I said, I started working with the coaches at a CrossFit box, and they really enjoyed it, and they recommended it to the members at the CrossFit box, and that resulted in me being able to do more classes. So quickly, I was not just coaching the coaches, I was also coaching the more experienced members. But then after maybe like 9 to 12 months, the owners of the CrossFit box decided that they didn't want to pursue CrossFit anymore. They just wanted to close the CrossFit box, open up a new place, and focus on like long-term personal training. And that proved to be a blessing in disguise, because it forced me to find another place to set up shop. And I got the opportunity to run my classes in CrossFit Copenhagen, which is now called Arca. And now, and especially back then, it was huge. It was like, it was really big. It was back then, I think they had like 10 boxes and maybe 10,000 members and 100 coaches. So I started coaching, and I got mass exposure, being able to work with most of the coaches, most of the experienced athletes, and also just like the broad masses of people. And back then, I didn't travel that much. Like, I didn't do seminars and training camps. It took me many years to develop the event format, which I'm using now. Back then, I just did small classes of 4 to 5 people, and I did 10, 15 classes per week. But in the beginning of 2012, Frederik Egidius, the boyfriend of Annie from Iceland, who is also Danish, he reached out to me and asked me if he could come and do some classes with me, and if I could do some personal training with him and help him with his weightlifting leading up to the regionals, which is what semifinals was called back then, and which back then in 2012 was held in a bit outside of Copenhagen. So I started working with him, and he really enjoyed it, and he benefited from it. And that showed at the regionals, where he did really well in the snatch ladder. And he told Annie, and Annie asked me if I wanted to hook up and do some sessions with her while she was in Copenhagen with Frederik. And we did so. She also really enjoyed it, and she invited me to come to Iceland and do some classes in her CrossFit box, CrossFit Reykjavik. And I just jumped on the opportunity, you know, really wanted to go to Iceland, really wanted to, you know, do classes abroad. And in the first class that I did, like, no kidding, like the very first class that I did, Bjorkvin, BKG, attended. Just like as a normal participant, you know, he paid for his spot and everything. And I was really, really impressed. Back then, he had only done CrossFit for about 6 months, which was really hard to believe, but he was just amazing. Like, to me, it was completely obvious that this was really a diamond in the rough, someone with really exceptional potential. So when the class was over, I asked him if he wanted to come back later the same week and do a session with me, just me and him. And he agreed to do that. He came back. We did a session together, power snatches. I still have the video. It's like old grainy video. And afterwards, he wanted to pay me. And I told him that, no, you don't have to pay me. I'm just going to help you get as far as you can. And then I started working with Björkvin. Of course, I still did everything I could to help Frederick and Annie. And, you know, Björkvin ended up doing really well. So that opened up a lot of doors for me in terms of working with other elite athletes, in terms of traveling more and doing classes and eventually training camps and seminars abroad. And one of the training camps I did was in Mallorca, at CrossFit Mallorca, Rob Martin's box. And Rob just told me that, you know, one of the guys from the gym would pick me up at the airport, and then I could stay with him. And I thought, you know, that sounds fine. It was Singleton. Like, Singleton picked me up at the airport. I stayed with him in his flat. He did the training camp with Rob and Axel and all the other guys. He really enjoyed it. And we really got along. Like, we just became instant friends. And he was like an osteopath and a CrossFit coach. And like me, like, really hungry, really ambitious, really wanted to compete as a coach. And since we got along and complemented each other well in our different abilities, I decided to invite him to one of my infamous elite training camps in Iceland. And this is like the end of 2014, maybe the beginning of 2015, something like that. So he came to one of these elite training camps in Iceland, in which I invited like all the best athletes that I had met on my travels. People like, Björkvin, because it was in his box, and, Stephen Fawcett, Phil Hirschgith, my students from Denmark, Mike Bjergård, André Hode, Philip Thun Bisgaard, Ben Massey, Robert Manlove, like all those guys. And then we had a year, 2015, where we just went all in, Singleton and I, and we did some really cool training camps and we got some really good results. Sarah was on board that year. That's the quick version.
Did I hear a story before that while you were working with John, that you were like forcibly removed from regionals in Europe or something? Was that 2015, 2016, somewhere around there?
Yeah, that's in 2016. You're bringing up all the good topics. Okay, like, so, you know, okay, the short version is that...
Who asked you to leave?
I'll answer, because, you know, I don't have anything to hide. You know, I'll answer the question. It's really very simple. You know, back then, I felt that the judging in competition was atrocious. And I still think that the judging in competition is atrocious. And... I gave expression to my belief in a very direct and very harsh way.
To who?
Well, just I had a Facebook group back then. I don't use it anymore, but back then I had a Facebook group, and sometimes I would go on rants, and I remember writing a post about how bad I thought that the judging was.
While you were there?
No. It was before, maybe 2 weeks before, four weeks before. It was before the competition. It was before the competition, but you know, the regionals had already kicked off. Not the European one, and I just wrote a very critical post about the judging, and some of the higher ups read it, and they didn't like the tone. Understandably, so I got banned.
Yeah, tone is still an issue nowadays, I think, for some of the higher ups. So you had a Facebook group, and does that mean that someone screenshotted in the group and sent it to someone then?
Yeah, but you know, presumably, like, I do understand it. Of course, you know, back then I thought that the judging was very bad. I still think that the judging is very bad. I think that all elite athletes will agree to that, at least secretly. But of course, that concern, that opinion has to be voiced in a certain way. Otherwise, you're just going to get into trouble. And back then, I didn't appreciate that. Now I do. So hopefully I won't get banned again for saying it.
Who asked you to leave? Did someone specific ask you to leave, or were you just refused entry?
Just, you know, the regional director.
Okay. And were you like pissed off, or were you just like, yeah, fair enough? Or were you like, this is worse than the fucking judging?
No, yeah, I was very disappointed. I was very disappointed, but, you know, it was a good learning lesson.
Yeah. Someone said earlier on, where the fuck is it? Oh, yeah. Eric is a wealth of knowledge. I've been stalking your Instagram for a while and it's so good. I'm the same. So I can't remember why or how, but your Instagram like popped up. I don't know, was it in my search thing or did someone share something on a story or whatever? And I was like, who's this? And actually, it might have been Paul Warrior maybe or someone like that shared something. Yeah. And I was like, who the fuck is Weightlifting 101? I remember thinking at the time, like, that's a fucking arrogant username to call yourself Weightlifting 101. That's like, especially in this realm, requires a level of confidence. And I was like, is this confidence like well-placed or misplaced? And I remember clicking in and you had a guy, I can't remember his name, but he was kind of like blonde, gingery, had a mustache. He either always wore either no t-shirt or a baggy oversized white t-shirt, one or the other. And he was it, like your whole profile almost was just this one guy, like every story, every post, whatever. And I was like, who the fuck is this guy? Cause it was like a nameless account basically. Cause it was all just this guy. And I was like, I know that's not the person that he's talking about. And that continued for a year, maybe 18 months. And then from my memory, unless either the algorithm fucked me up or your page basically just went quiet for like a prolonged period of time or became less noticeable for a prolonged period of time. And now in the last 5 months, you're everywhere. So I'm curious, did you fall out of favor? Did you fall out of love with like coaching or with CrossFit and have you fallen back into it? Or what's the timeline of like dipping away and then coming back?
Yeah. Yeah, so the guy that you're referring to is called Thomas, and we spent a lot of time together. And I helped him, develop his barbell game. And he benefited a lot from it, and I benefited a lot from it. As I told you previously, you know, like I really enjoy taking people and transforming them, like transforming their barbell game. And I did that with him and I really enjoyed it and learned so much from it. But COVID hit with the lockdowns and everything. And my lifestyle back then was very, very much bound up with traveling and coaching and running my events, mostly abroad, right? I was working a lot. I was traveling a lot. And almost all of my events were based abroad. And when I was back in Copenhagen, I didn't really want to work. You know, I just wanted to like train and chill and yeah, maybe coach a bit. But then it was like friends like Thomas that I would help with weightlifting. I wouldn't like run events as such.
Yeah.
And, you know, with the lockdown, everything changed all of a sudden very drastically. I couldn't travel, I couldn't really work, I didn't really know what to do. So I decided to, you know, make a lot of changes in my life. I decided to pull the plug on a lot of people. I decided to restructure my business. I decided that, you know, I was kind of a bit tired of CrossFit and weightlifting and needed a bit of a break. So I just wanted to, you know, buy some dumbbells and just go down in a park and just destroy myself with a dumbbell and some burpees. And just keep things really simple. And after the first lockdown, when things started to open up, I was kind of in doubt about what to do. Like, should I go back to traveling and coaching weightlifting and everything? And then when the second lockdown hit, I was like, fuck this. You know, for now, I'm just going to forget about CrossFit, forget about weightlifting, and I'm just going to commit to outdoor training because it's what I want to do with my own training. And, you know, I want to keep coaching and I want to like build an outdoor training group. I want to be like busy with a good project while this lockdown lasts. Because, you know, back then nobody could tell, you know, is it 3 months? Is it 3 years? And I didn't just, you know, want to sit in a couch and wait for things to open up so I could start traveling again. I wanted to be busy with something solid, like a project that I thought was worthwhile. So just did a lot of outdoor training myself, you know, just like dumbbells and burpees and running, just like super simple, super basic, but also really hard because it was simple and hard training. And it was outdoor training in Copenhagen all year round. And Copenhagen or Denmark, just like Ireland in January, is challenging if you want to do outdoor training. Yeah. And like one of my principles is I don't work with people that don't want to work with themselves. Like, you know, I don't want to motivate people. You know, I want to help them get better, but they need to, you know, they need some sort of intrinsic motivation. And with the outdoor training, I mean, if you're willing to do outdoor training in Denmark all year round, I can respect that. You know, then you have a level of intrinsic motivation that I can respect and work with.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I just, I did all that outdoor training. I really enjoyed it. But since it didn't have anything to do with CrossFit or weightlifting, I kind of fell off the radar and also didn't follow the sport or anything. I was just in, let's say, my own bubble, a different bubble for a period of time. But it was a very, very good chapter for me. It, I really developed as a coach. And it was also where I met my girlfriend. She was one of the first members of my outdoor training group. And we spent a lot of time together during the lockdowns, training together, just enjoying each other's company outside of training as well. And it was the day she told me that she was pregnant that I decided to pull the plug on outdoor training and start to rebuild weightlifting 101. Because three things. The first thing is that with outdoor training, I was bound to Copenhagen. I had around 20 classes per week, and I had to do most of those classes, if not all of them. And my girlfriend, she loves the countryside. She loves nature. She loves animals. Her motto is, nature over cities and animals over people. So, I didn't want us to be bound to Copenhagen by continuing with the outdoor training. That's one thing. The other thing was that when she told me I was pregnant, I knew that, okay, now I have to start making serious money because I have to take care of my family. I'm a bit of a hobo myself. Like, I could easily live like a bum. It doesn't really matter so much to me. I'm not very materialistic. So, like, I can live like a hobo, but I don't want my family to live like hobos.
Yeah.
And then the third thing is that, like, I had the feeling for some time that I couldn't develop more as a coach with the outdoor training, that it had been a really good chapter. I was able to develop as a coach, but that I really needed to get back to weightlifting 101 and have an opportunity to work with really good athletes again. In order to apply everything that I had learned with the outdoor training and in order to continue developing as a coach.
I guess it's probably, maybe not necessarily easier, but that, you know, you're almost guaranteed that intrinsic motivation if you're working with the tip of the spear. Like, you're not going to have someone there that's like, I want to get better, but I'm not willing to do the work, because they're already at a certain level. So of just general physical preparedness.
That's true. You don't get to that level unless you're motivated.
Yeah. Say that thing in January. So you've had people I've seen you work with say are like the training plan athletes. I've seen you work with like Heinrich, Jana, Reggie. I've seen you work with JST athletes like Jen. I'm trying to think who else I've seen you work with. Victor Hoffer, like KWPO. Is it like Colin Bosthart as well? He's going to be fucking huge, I think. Is it a case of you see someone and say, hey, I can help you, or people see you work with someone else and say, hey, can you help me? Or do coaches, like, say, does Steve Fawcett, because he used to work with you, see you ramping back up and be like, hey, Victor, you need to get in touch with this guy?
Okay, yeah. Like, I have a very simple strategy. I work with the elite for free, and then the broad masses of people have to pay. And I think that's fair. If an elite athlete doesn't want to work with me, that's fine. If someone who's not an elite athlete thinks it's unfair that they have to pay and the elite doesn't, you know, that's also fine. The person can just become elite and then that person doesn't have to pay anymore. And my definition of elite is that you have to qualify for semifinals as an individual.
Okay.
Right? If you qualify for semifinals as an individual, you know, then you're elite. And, you know, I do make certain exceptions. Now, let's take Lucy McGonigal from Ireland, or is it Northern Ireland?
Ireland. We'll claim her, Ireland.
Okay, I don't want to get it wrong. She did qualify for semifinals last year, and hopefully she will again this year. But even if she didn't, she's a games athlete as a teen,
yeah,
right? So she still qualifies as elite in my mind. So it's like a general guideline, but I do make exceptions when it makes sense. So I work with Elite for free, and then the broad masses of people have to pay because I have to put food on the table and support my family. Now, the way that I work with the Elite is three ways. One, I have my events, which they can attend for free, seminars, training camps, and Elite training camps. And then I also offer video analysis. So if someone sends me a video and ask me for technical feedback, I'll provide technical feedback. And then there is programming. Now, of course, all the elite athletes are following a program. Most of them have like a personal coach. So I don't really provide a full program, but sometimes a person needs some kind of technical drill to improve a given lift, and then I'll provide them with that, which is something very specific and something which can be easily integrated into their existing program without it ruining anything.
Is that like, say, you put up the other day about that Yano was jumping, so you gave him no feet snatches or something, and that was just you saying anytime you got snatches, Dutch, don't move your feet, basically. Yeah, so then he can just do it with his program.
Yeah. So, you know, take Victor Hoffer from France, who is a part of Hard Work Pays Off and who has Stephen Fawcett as his coach. I think Victor is a good technician, but he's not a great technician. But he needs to become a great technician. He agrees, and Stephen agrees, and they believe that I can help him make that transformation, make that transition from good to great. And that's really what I want to do. It doesn't matter who I'm working with. I'm open to working with anyone who wants to work with me in good faith. The only thing I require is just a good attitude. And then regardless of the starting point, I'll help that person improve with a strong emphasis on technique.
Do you ever get pushback from coaches? Like, obviously Steve knows you, Yami knows you. But do you ever get pushback from other coaches, or have athletes ever reported it where they'll say like, oh, I'm going to do this like elite training camp with Eric. And they're like, no, fuck off. Like, I'm your coach and, you know, whatever. Obviously it's a closed-minded attitude, but I'm just curious if people get territorial with that kind of stuff.
Yeah, no, not these days, because, you know, like one of the mistakes I made back in the day, like in the singleton days, was that I tried to compete as a CrossFit coach, even though I wasn't a CrossFit coach. Now that lesson has been learned. And what I'm doing now is I try to work with everyone, like all the athletes and all the coaches. So I have a really good relationship with Andre from No Shortcuts. I have a good relationship with Stephen from Hardwork Pays Off, formerly GST. I have a good relationship with Jack from GST, with Yami from the training plan, with Philip from Apex Athletics.
Oh, yeah.
And like, I try to have a good constructive relationship with all the coaches and all the athletes. And like, honestly, I think all these coaches know that if I just stay in my lane, which is technical weightlifting, if I just stay within my lane, I can do a really good job. Like, and all these coaches and all these elite athletes are very much interested in improving their barbell game wherever they can. So if I just stay within my lane and I focus on helping athletes become better in terms of technique and movement efficiency and so on, everybody's happy.
It's like your Instagram page is like a who's who, especially like Europe, of like European CrossFit. Like, that's so, like, founder of RAD, BKG, like, founded and like grew HBPO, and then JST, and then moved and is like in charge of HBPO. Like, are these, is your page like a deliberate advertisement window, basically, like a shop window of like, look at these, I helped all these, I help him, hey, you know this guy, I've helped him, like, games athlete, I've helped him. Like, is that the, because like, there's two, when I look at your Instagram and like, I kind of follow it with a keen eye, enjoy following it, and there's two, there's a few different things that pop up. So like, for me, one, it's a really good advertisement for you when you have a training camp. Like, it's a no-brainer that the elite athletes do it for free, because now you're advertising your services to all of their following, or anyone, if they ever improve or if they ever look better, it's like, oh, well, that's because, you know, that camp that I saw them on. But then I'm also curious, like, you know, that intrinsic motivation that you talk about and that the elites have. Like, I feel like if I spent 30 seconds with you dissecting my lifting, that this is what I would look like. I just have so much, like, you're very to the point and very like, you know, you don't pull any punches and you don't mince your words and you don't put in any fluff language. Like, you're critical, like publicly critical of people's lifting in a, what would you call it? Constructive criticism type way. You're not just saying like, this guy lifts like shit, but you're, you know, he moves his feet and he shouldn't move his feet and that kind of stuff. Have you had athletes that you've worked with? I know I'm going on a ramble now, but this just popped in when I saw Heinrich. Do you have athletes that you've worked with who have said like, you know what, Eric, go fuck yourself. Like, I'm going to go with someone who does mince their words and who is a bit kinder.
Like, imagine that you have an elite athlete and you go on and on about how that elite athlete was 8 or 10 years ago, you know, and like, an athlete is supposed to develop and supposed to constantly become a better version of himself or herself. And so should a coach. So I think in the past, I was very much my way or the highway. I was very unfiltered. And a lot of people like that because it's entertaining. But I was also able to produce good results. Now I think that I'm able to produce really good results without being needlessly harsh or needlessly insulting. And it's, you know, it has nothing to do with me becoming a father or become like getting more soft. It's just my coaching is better. Like, my coaching is better because I'm better as a person. Yeah. And one of the things that I really benefited from in terms of the outdoor training that I did was like understanding my audience better, getting much, much better at sizing up the person or the group of people that I was working with, and then adjusting myself to them and to then move them up from there. Does it make sense?
Yeah, it does. But say like this now, like, so when you have a video of Victor, and like, when I read these captions, like, I chuckle to myself when I read them, because like, there's nothing bad in the captions, you know what I mean? But to someone, to you, a conversation, say, between you and Victor, or you and Steve, this sentence probably, the three of you will probably read it and be like, yeah, like that's 100% accurate. But then me, who isn't an elite coach or who isn't an elite athlete striving to get better, looks at that and is like, oh, geez, like, could have worded that differently. But then obviously when you click on to the second story, it's like, you know, you elaborate on it. But just when you see that first one, and I'm also curious, like, when I look at this, I'm like, geez, man, Victor's a good lifter. When you look at it, you see like uncontrolled movement. Like, when you came back from your outdoor training, which you said was dumbbells and burpees and stuff and running and, you know, like kind of bodyweight stuff.
Right.
Did you have to retrain your eye? Because like what you're looking at, like I look at that and I think, fuck, Victor is strong. That's a good lift. You look and you obviously see like one wobble of the knee or like an elbow not doing what it's supposed to do. Like, you're talking minutia in terms of 99% of coaches.
Yeah, listen, he wants to win the games.
No, I understand that, but I just mean like being able to spot it. Like, did you have to retrain your eye to be like?
Yeah, listen. Okay, I'm gonna answer your questions. Like, but first, let me say that like Victor wants to win the games, or like certainly he wants to go to the games. He wants to do really well at the games. One day he wants to get on the podium, and I'm sure that he would like to be a champion one day, because that's just the kind of person that he is. Just like Björkvin, just like Jonne, like. In the heart, they want to win the games. Like, they want to be the best, and they believe that they could become the best. Otherwise, they wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
And when you have people that have proven themselves, who are at an elite level, then of course you have to hold them to a much, much higher standard. I agree that the lift that you just saw was a good lift, but it wasn't perfect. Far from it. And that's the point. Now, about training my eye. No, I didn't have to retrain my eye, but like when I'm coaching a seminar, I take people, the group of participants, through what I consider one very long, very extensive and detailed sequence. And it's just like a performance in a way. So, you know, I wasn't rusty as a coach in any way, because I've been coaching more than ever with the outdoor training, but I was a little bit rusty coaching weightlifting. It wasn't my eye or anything. It was just the, you know, specific drills and the order of the drills and so on. And actually, you know, one of the reasons why I got back to weightlifting, I told you that, you know, I made the decision when my girlfriend told me that she was pregnant, but before she told me she was pregnant, she had been punking me for not teaching her weightlifting. As I told you, she was in the outdoor training group and she was the best member. She was really, really fit. And she had reached a point with the outdoor training where it didn't make sense for her to get better at running, or better at burpees, or better at single arms, or better at throwing around a dumbbell. Like, she needed something much more difficult in order to continue her athletic development. And it was just so obvious that she should do weightlifting. So I began coaching her weightlifting. And then I kind of realized, okay, I've been missing this.
Yeah.
Like, I've been missing the barbell. And I also started posting about it on Instagram. Posting lifts of her, and a lot of people wrote me, man, it's so good to see that you're back coaching weightlifting, like, fuck your dumbbell shit, you know, it's so boring, please come back doing seminars and training camps. So like the seed was definitely planted before I made the final decision.
Just there's comments. So Ben says, looking forward to our seminar on Friday. We've got him all weekend in Kendal. That's in the UK, surely, is it? With a name like Welton and a place name like Kendal.
Yeah, it's a few hours from Manchester.
Heidi's asking if I've ever tried pure carnivore. No. Nope. Augusta says, Eric, just shut up and let me talk. Yeah, I heard that too. Were you in the Isle of Man? Did you do a seminar in the Isle of Man?
I did.
And did you enjoy it?
I did, very much so.
It's cool. I have to go back. Shit, there was something that you said there. Fuck, I can't remember. Oh, do you prefer, so say like I'm not good at lifting, like I'm not technically proficient, or you know, don't have the prerequisite strength or mobility or athleticism or balance, agility, any of the skills required. If you had a choice between, say, someone like me who has, we'll pretend I'm 10 years younger, so I have more potential. So someone who's raw, who hasn't done it, but wants to get better, versus someone who's like at like, say, 98%, like just needs like minuscule little tweaks. Would you rather take someone who's like got obvious glaring faults that are like, oh, fucking hell. I mean, straight away, look at your back when in your like, you know, in the start of your lift, you need to do this, start of your, versus, oh, your little finger comes off the bar for a millisecond just as you're about to jerk. We need to fix that. Do you know, like, is the minutia what draws you in, or do you like just improving a turd and turning it into like a diamond?
I care more about the personality. Like, so, like, okay, I would prefer if people were not at a complete beginner stage. But that's also because it's kind of holding the group back a bit. Remember that I very rarely do one-to-one coaching. It's almost always group-based. And if you have someone with a good attitude, but who is at a, let's say, low level, like a beginner stage, even if that person is doing his or her very best, and even if I'm doing my very best, that person is bound to hold back the group a bit. So I would definitely prefer that it's a person who has the basics down, and that I can help just become even better, and who at the same time is increasing the level of the group. But we should talk about you. What's your 1R rem squat snatch?
Oh, fuck all.
All time.
All time. I have a vague memory of doing like 70 kilos, but I'm not sure.
Was it a power snatch into an overhead squat, or was it really a squat snatch? Did you catch it?
No, I think I would say I caught it like on the way down. I didn't catch it at the bottom. I'd say I caught it. It wasn't a power, but it was like, could have been arguably a power, but I wrote it down. You know, I didn't like catch it and then slowly start a squat, or like move my feet and start squatting. Yeah. And then clean and jerk. I think I remember doing like 103 or something once, 104 or something random.
You know, I have a funny story.
You could have let that silence go a bit longer if you really wanted to stick the knife in.
I remember once asking Bjorkvin, BKG, how long it took for him to snatch 100. And he did so after 6 months of CrossFit. And then I asked him, when did you clean and jerk 100? And then he had to think for a few seconds. And then he replied, it was always there. Good answer.
Yeah.
But hey, you should come to a seminar. Hopefully I'll be doing a seminar in Ireland or Northern Ireland this year, and then you should come.
Yeah, but you know, you're talking about that person who holds back the group.
It's okay.
You'll make an exception. So that's this weekend, Kendall. And then you're in Germany. It's pretty much every fucking weekend. You're even doing. Oh, that's Easter weekend, is it? That's Easter Sunday.
Yeah, I don't care.
Man. So Germany, Austria, France, Germany, 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 Finland, elite training camp. So who's going to be at that one then? Does that mean that I can't go, like, if I was in Finland and I was like, oh, Eric's coming to Finland, but then I can't go to that one unless I've qualified for semifinals?
You would have to qualify for the games.
Oh, fuck. Okay. I see. So that's going to be like Heinrich, Heinrich, Jana.
Yeah. So, you know, there are seminars and training camps and elite training camps. And elite training camps are invitation only. And the elite training camp in Finland in June is a games preparation camp.
Right.
So it's going to be 1 week. You know, like, imagine that you do the semifinals. You know, the week after, you're pretty sore, you're pretty tired, you're not going to do that much training. But if you qualified for the games, like, at some point you have to make the mental switch, like, you have to get back to training. Like, now it actually begins, because you have to prepare for the games.
You could say you have to get back to the bar if you wanted to say something.
But so, you know, that particular elite training camp is only going to be for games athletes that need to switch on, who are interested in really working technically on their bubble game, like really taking their technique to the next level, and combining it with a lot of non-weightlifting training. And it's also going to be an opportunity for some of the coaches of the athletes to take part, so that the coaches can work with the athletes in the non-weightlifting sessions.
Oh, okay, I follow.
Yeah. So, you know, the program is still under construction, but I'm sure it's going to be a really good training camp. And I'm talking a lot to the athletes that are presumed to take part. They have to qualify for the games first, of course, but I'm talking to some of them and, you know, getting their input so I know exactly what they would like.
What's the difference between, I can figure out the difference between an elite training camp and a training camp, but what's the difference between a training camp and a seminar? Is a seminar like you go in and take whoever's in a gym, whoever wants to go through like a weightlifting workshop, basically, versus training camp is people who are looking to hone their skills, basically.
Okay. So anyone within reason can attend a seminar. Like, anyone who has two arms, two legs, who can count to 10, who's willing to listen and to work hard, can come to a seminar. If you do a seminar and you do it well and you're hungry for more, then you can go to a training camp.
Okay.
And then there are also elite training camps. In the next one, you have to be a 2024 European Games athlete in order to participate. But there might be other elite training camps where exceptions will be made for certain semi-finalists. It depends. I did an elite training camp in Tenerife in January, and some of the participants were not games athletes, but they were still invited.
Yeah. Do you look for something specific in them, or is it if you've heard of them or if you've seen them and been excited by how they move or that kind of thing?
Yeah. Take Colin Bushart, or take Victor Hoffer, or take Jennifer Moore from Scotland. You know, those three athletes are not games athletes yet, but I believe that they will become games athletes, and I want to help them get there.
I think they're going to, the three names you've said there are going to be games athletes this year, I think.
Right.
They're my three of my picks.
Also, sometimes, you know, say, you know, if Stephen Fawcett writes me and says, "Hi, Eric, I have a really promising young talent. Can this person come to one of your training camps?" I'm not going to say no.
Yeah.
So sometimes coaches reach out to me because they feel that they have an exceptional talent and they would like that person to come and work with me, but maybe also work with me in a context where they will meet the people that are at the level that they aspire to. You know, back in the day when I did the elite training camps in Iceland, I think one of the game changers for some of the young athletes, like Mike Bjergård, Philip Thun-Bisgaard, André Houdet, who many people will know, is that they got to meet Bjørkvin when he was a high-level games athlete, so they could see, this is where you need to go. Like, this is the level that you have to be at. I think that was a very formative experience for them. Being able to, train with athletes like Bjørkvin, Sarah, Stephen, Phil Hesketh, and so on.
Augustus PR'd his power snatch yesterday, 110. Wow, his full snatch is on minus 113 kilos. Oh my God, that's terrible. Minus 113. Didn't you say to me before that you, I don't know, was it you that said it or Emma McQuay that said it, that I'd never make it through a seminar?
I think it was Emma who said it.
Bitch.
I'll make sure that you make it through the seminar, but you have to show up.
When is that likely to be?
I don't know. I'll let you know.
Okay, I'll go. If it's not like when my baby is due, I'll go. That would be interesting. Yeah, minus 113 kilos when you drop the bar on your head. That sounds accurate. Are you surprised by, it's funny when you name the list there, like Steve Fawcett, Andre Houdet, Andre especially, Steve Fawcett, Andre Houdet, BKG, Yana, like they're all sublime movers. Do you know what I mean? They're like technically, like Andre Houdet is like, to me, to my eye, is like fucking hell, he moves so well. Like his lifts are just so nice to watch. Like his heaviest and his lightest always look the same. So it's interesting for people who are watching or listening. Like, I think that says a lot, that the list of names that you've worked with are a list of people who, if you watch them lift, you're like, wow, that's a good lifter. Like it's like, do you take pride in that? Like the historical, what would you call it? Like potency of your coaching or whatever, or the impact of your coaching on the names that you've worked with, like the fact that they're renowned for their lifts and stuff.
Yeah, I'm happy about it, of course. But a few things. The first thing is that Andre, to use him as an example, wasn't born a good mover. He was born with the potential to become one. Like he also had to work really hard in order to become a very good technician. Like I have many old videos of Andre doing weightlifting, you know, videos that are 6 or 8 or 10 years old, where he had potential, but he wasn't a good technician yet.
Yeah.
It required a lot of coaching and it required a lot of hard work to get him to that point. That's the first thing. The other thing is that, you know, when people say that, well, if it's a light lift or heavy lift, it all looks the same. It's like, no, it doesn't. You know, he still makes mistakes and, you know, he should be called out for those mistakes. And I think that's one of the things that I do well as a coach. Like I really like Andre. Like I really like Björkvin and Jonne and Victor. Like I really like those guys and I have a lot of respect for them, but I don't put them on a pedestal. Like I don't pretend that they're perfect. And it's exactly because I see their mistakes and explain to them that they are mistakes and how to correct them and why it's important that they do correct them, that I'm able to work with them.
Yeah. The other thing with the list of names that you mentioned is that they were all, obviously some are like just starting out or, you know, like are in the midst of their journey or whatever. Some of them are retired. Some of them are still at their peak somehow after like fucking 30 years or whatever, BKG and Yana. They are all very successful and have been very successful in the sport, like the names that you've worked with. Like Steve was first to do individual team and masters from the UK. Like he's built like coaching companies. Like he's obviously a really good coach, but he was a really good athlete first. Phil Heskett, one of the first from the UK to go to the games. Like Yana, just renowned for consistency, BKG, like they're all like strong names in the sport. I'm curious like what you think about Sarah and her, say, trajectory compared to those guys, where she was on the cusp of like being one of the best to do it, and there was like, there was so much hype about her, and so much, there still is a lot of hype about her now, but there was so much hype about her, and it was like, oh, she, like, I think maybe people expected her to do what Tia ended up doing, of like just taking over, that she was just going to be the next thing, and she was just going to do a Froning on it and be around for a long time and stuff. And she kind of stuttered and stalled, and there was injuries, and she kind of changed training camps and moved and changed again and moved again, and kind of never really reached, some would argue, never really reached her potential in the sport. And as someone that had worked with her early doors, and then you mentioned earlier on that you stopped focusing on the sport and that you kind of didn't pay attention to it for a while during the kind of 2020, 2022 kind of years. When you came back, are you like, did you expect her career to go to the way that it has gone? Did you expect her to be better? Do you think that she reached her potential? Do you think that she didn't? Do you think that she made mistakes or coaches made mistakes?
Well, I think she, okay, she definitely didn't reach her potential. I think a lot of people, including herself, expected her to win the games at least once. And I think that she had the potential to win the games. Now, if I could go back in time, I would have approached things very, very differently. But I'm sure all coaches and all athletes can say that. Like, I wish I could go back in time with the knowledge and the maturity that I have now, because I could have done much, much better. I think one of the reasons why I hold Björkman in such high regard is because of all the athletes I've known, I think he played his hand the best. You know, when Björkman started CrossFit, he was an incredible talent, really a prodigy, but he still had like a lot of problems that he had to overcome. He had old injuries that he carried into the sport. He was really, really lacking in upper body flexibility. And he overcame it all. And I think in the final analysis, he played his hand extremely well. I can't think of any athletes that have played their hand better than Björkman. And, you know, that's why he's been able to be at the top level for a decade. Like, you know, be at the top level for a decade. That's easy to say, but it's very hard to do. And I think that Sarah had the potential to do really great things. And of course, you know, she has done great things. I'm not going to deny that. I think she could have done even better, but she wasn't able to play her hand as good as Björkman did. And, you know, there are many reasons for that. But I think that's how I see it.
Do you blame yourself for some of that? Just the way you said, I wish I could go back in time. I wish I would have handled it differently.
No, like I think I brought a lot of good things and some bad things.
Just there's the bad things like intensity or high expectation or something, or.
No, I think, you know, one of the things that I really strive for now as a coach is to understand that, like, as a coach or, you know, as a person in any kind of relationship, you can contribute with good and with bad. And in the past, I did a lot of good and a lot of bad. Whereas now I really try to only do good and eliminate everything that's bad. And obviously, I'm not always able to do that, but I'm keenly aware of it, and I try very hard.
What's bad? Like, what's a glaring example of bad? Now, it doesn't even have to be a real example, but a hypothetical example of something bad you could do.
Well, just, you know, being impatient and getting easily angry. Okay. Or if you get disappointed in an athlete, maybe showing it in and in a way which isn't constructive.
Okay, yeah. Arguing, like, instead of... Yeah, I get you. That's just age as well, though, right? And experience.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, age, experience, maturity.
Are you calmer now, or do you just bite your tongue more?
Well, I'm biting my tongue a bit. Now, of course, you know, I could go into more detail.
I don't mean now. I don't mean now, but I mean like when you're coaching in general.
Okay. So two things. You know, like I know a lot of elite athletes really well, and in order to help them effectively as a coach, like I try to really understand them and really talk to them. And there are certain things that I'll say on a podcast, but there are other things that I won't say because I think that it betrays their trust in me.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah. Um, The other thing about biting my tongue, it's like, as a coach, to me, this is just my opinion. You know, it's not about what you know. It's not about what you say. It's not even about what you do. At the end of the day, a coach has to be judged on the performance of his or her athletes. Right? So everything I do, like the way I act, everything to me now is geared toward being effective and helping my students develop regardless of their level. So it's not that I'm being dishonest. It's not that I'm, you know, afraid of being direct with people. I just try to work with people in a way that's actually constructive, which is actually effective, which actually makes them better. So I'm as soft or as hard as I need to be, depending on the situation.
Okay, yeah, I follow.
I don't want to be a controversial figure just to get attention. I think it was like that in the past, at least to some extent. I'm just done with that. Like, I just want to focus on my work and do my work well.
Yeah. I think it's seasonal as well, like where you kind of, not you, but like, I think some people think that that's what you're supposed to do. And then it works. And then you keep doing it. And then eventually you just realize, like, maybe there's a different way to approach people, or maybe there's a different way to gain notoriety, as in like what you're saying now of, if your athletes do really well, you're a really good coach, versus if you're heard or seen on the sideline or, you know, like courtside or whatever, and your athlete's bombing and you're shouting at them, like, you'll probably be judged a bit differently than just quietly watching them succeed, I guess.
Have you watched the documentary called Jiro Dreams of Sushi?
No.
You have to watch that documentary. It's a documentary about arguably the best sushi chef in the world. And, you know, if you think that you work hard, if you think that you pay attention to detail, then think again. Like to be a renowned sushi chef in Japan requires like unbelievable conscientiousness, like unbelievable work ethics.
Hang on, I'm still here. My camera overheated. Sorry. Okay.
No, but you know, watching that documentary, watching similar documentaries, just has made me.
There you go. Fantastic documentary.
It really is. But watching that documentary in particular has made me focus much more on my craft. That's really what I want now. I just want to develop my craft. I think that if I am really, really good at what I do, which is teaching people weightlifting from a technical perspective, then all doors will open and all good things will come.
That's cool. I respect it. So if people want to find out more, they can go. Your website is really nice, by the way.
Thank you. Yeah, they can go to my website. They can go to Instagram. They can always just write me.
I like the fact that these kind of look like SD cards. I don't know why that appeals to me, but it's a novelty that I like. But it's a very smooth interface. I don't know that I'm getting kind of nerdy, but I just really like it. And then go to your, weightlifting_101. If you want to watch like cool stories of people lifting, if you want some nostalgia, some trips down history lane, if you want to see what the current open champion, I think, is doing in his weightlifting, or unofficial open champion. Or if you want to see what Steve Fawcett looked like before he had wrinkles.
Hey, I have to add that I'm really impressed with Stephen Fawcett. I don't understand how he gets all that work done. Like, he's able to juggle, well, like three things. So it seems to me that like he's in a good marriage and he's a good father. Yeah. And he's doing really great work with Hard Work Pays Off. And then at the same time, he's able to qualify for semifinals and games.
Yeah, him qualifying for semifinals last year was fucking nuts. Like, in the that was crazy.
Yeah.
Crazy. Yeah. Crazy. And then going as a Masters, crazy. And coaching people when he's there, like working with Jake and the other, like it's nuts. I don't know how he does it. And it, like, I always find, maybe I'm hypercritical or something of myself, but when I see, like, say Ben from Rad, like building his business, traveling all around the world, all that kind of stuff. And then lovely, happy family at home. And then I see Steve do the same, lovely, happy family. And he's like working weird hours because his like business and clients and shit are in America and all that. And then I'm like arguing with my son because he insists on like pissing standing up instead of sitting down. I'm like, what, like, how are these guys juggling so much stuff? Like, yeah, it's crazy. They're crazy impressive. But it's that intrinsic motivation that you talked about. I think that from when they're athletes just carries over to like what you're doing. They just want to be elite coaches or elite business owners or elite. Like Ben wants to have the best shoe and the best brand in the space. Steve wants to be best coach with the best coaching company in the space. Do you know, like, it's that competitive nature, I guess. It's crazy.
Yeah. Crazy. But you know, you have a lot of people that are competitive without being competent.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah.
So, like a rudderless boat. I don't know where I was going with that. But listen, thanks, Eric. Keep me posted on your Irish seminar. And I'll get out the WD-40. I'll limber up. I'll grease my joints.
You'll have to come. Emma McQuaid and I will come and pick you up.
Yeah. No, I will. If I can, I will. If it works child-wise, I will. But thanks. Appreciate it. Thanks, everyone, for watching as well in the comments and all that kind of stuff. Really appreciate your time, Eric.